This one is called Once Upon a Time. Fado, 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 i.e. a really long time ago, when the winds were free of us godly guests, godly aliens, trees were the hosts, and seas teeming with wonder. Fado, 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 i.e. a really, really long time ago, before we tamed the mammoth and stole women in scores. There lived then, yes, even then, the eagle and the crow. It was one bird, though, not two like today, the Ira Prochon. Fado, 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 a really, really long time ago, was a bird that flew with a trail of time. Whatsoever it met or passed, the great Ira Prochon would gift abundantly with time. The magic ones, they wept that day, their tears filled the sky, and the great Ira Prochon was no more. Fado, 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 that day when her heart was broken in two. Come back, wailed the shaman, but all that remained when the sun set was a disgusted crow, not fit for a pot, and a furious eagle, too swift to catch. Since then, Fado, 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 a really long time ago, Ira Prochon said no to this unguardy guest, unguardy alien, Ira eagle to the sky, the eye of Earth's new omens, and crow Prochon to the trees, the ear of Earth's new vigilance, hearing no tears, seeing no pleas, just passing the time left to create it. Fado, 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 until the unguarded alien goes, or unbreaks the pact, and returns the ear of Prochon, the time bird, from a really, really long time ago. I wrote this year when I was up in up to the Solstice Festival. And again, I performed with Lisa Kelly at the Sunrise of the Solstice, as I thought. And the Denchankas one, which I'm really shortly. And this is one poem I wrote called These Kings of Tara. The wind blew Tara's name to us. Us in Scythia, Egypt, Spain, Athens, Scandinavia, Normandy, Carthage, Rome, and Constantinople. To us across the ages, the name of Tara has blown, and sweetly did her name arrive. So gently we dropped our lives, left our homes behind, crossed the great forests and seas to join her fold, to embrace her depths, her promises of life and youth, to behold her great delights, her great teachers, her great kings. But where have you been, kings of these days, having tea with merchants, while night inherits our days? Where have you been, kings, while the sealing promises you made wither and refuse these fields, while dark lords break our sacred places and barge through the markets, plundering, unstayed? How have you smiled at these new brothers, these brothers who illuminate the new? What is the annual quota for nudges and winks? Which of tomorrow's qualities have you promised away? Did no one tell of the whispers that pour from sacred grounds, of the desecrations and banishments that surely follow? What praise will you receive, kings, and what sapphire? O kings, remember not the ways of Kerach and Chet, or these new world illusions. Turn your nostrils to the wind quickly, and help the child to grow instead. Kings of today, when will you show the beast to the sea? What Baru will oust this new domination, so the winds may blow gently again, and that once more her name may be heard? very short quatrain, just a quatrain which I wrote today in response to someone came onto the Tara Watch group site and said, why isn't anyone bringing up any ancient Irish curses against these governments? And I kind of remembered having knowledge and reading of it. And there is an old poem called Aglam Dithan, which is ancient Gaelic, and it's not modern Irish at all. But it basically means the satire of destruction, or a satire intended to create harm, which was used originally by druids and wizards. And you need seven of them, and it's a whole ritual. And so I typed back and I gave them this little information. I said, we need seven satirists to do this. So I don't know, maybe there's someone out there trying to figure out if they can get seven satirists to do this. But this was the quatrain I wrote today. Miscreants, ministers and minions, for Tara's thieving, that your days from here fill with the guilt and the grieving, and that all may now shun you for your unbelieving, for what has been your weaving will be henceforth your leaving. And then just to end off, this is one of the Dinshankas. There are five of them written for Tara. These are written down, taken down 1,000 years ago, and translated into English. This world, transient, its splendor, perishable gathering of 100 hosts, deceitful to describe is the multitude of delights, save only the adoration of the King of all things. Perished is every law concerning high fortune, crumbles to the clay is every ordinance. Tara, though she be desolate today, once on a time was the habitation of heroes. There was no exhaustion of her many-sided towers. Where was the assembly of storied troops? Many were the bands whose home was the green soiled grassy keep. It was a stronghold of famous men and sages, a castle like a trunk with warrior skins, a ridge conspicuous to view in the time of Cormac, grandson of Conn. Fair is the title that protected, the name he chose to mark it out among cities, the fort of Crowfend, pen of victory, excelled Bowens, millstone of combat. When Cormac was among the famous, bright shone the fame of his career, no keep like Tara could be found. She was the goal of the world's road. Strong before hosts was the might of this king who used to ride through Tara. Better for us than tribes unnumbered is the tale of his household retinue. The great house with the thousands of sharp soldiers was not obscure to posterity. The shining fort with the choicest of the illustrious 700 feet was its measure. Fierce folly did not hold sway over it, nor strictness of harsh wisdom. It was not too small for separation. 6 times 5 cubits was its height. 9 walls it had. Fierce fight could not demolish. With 9 ramparts round about them, with noble equipment of the noble skins, it was a fort illustrious and impregnable. The dwelling of the king, king over Erin, was a refuge, a keep, a fortress, where upon was poured out the sparkling wine. There were 50 chambers in it. 50 heroes with coronets. It was a castle not foolish and brawling. That was the tale according to the counts of fortresses in every chamber of the number. Goodly was the throng in this wise. The gold gleamed from their weapons. 50 stately couches there were, and 50 men to each shining couch. 7 cubits, an honest reckoning. Before the crowded warlike company with blazing torches burning, that was the measure of the hearth. Another 7, I have heard, made in truth a brightness beyond denial, majestic, notable, noble, beautiful chandeliers of brass. This sunny shining citadel, festive, martial, with cask staves therein amid radiant hospitality, were doors 27 in number. That was the right of that king, the vessel from which that host would drink, a vast capacity with the full contents thereof, 300 draughts there were in that vessel. Harmonious and stately was the carouse, of the fiery chieftains and noblemen. There were none neglected of the number. 300 cupbearers dispensed the liquor. 9 times 50 beakers to choose from. Their abundance was a case of choice, except what was carbuncle, clear and strong. All was gold and silver. 30 steaming cooks in attendance unceasingly with victuals and abundant supply on the jolly kings and chieftains. 50 noble stewards with the well-guarded honorable prince. 50 festive spruce lackeys with each 50 of kingly champions. 50 men standing guarded the sturdy wolf as long as the king was a-drinking to ward off mischances for him. Right. You see, I'm pleased about what's happening at Fire. I'm sure a lot of people are up now. So yes. I'd like to invite up to read some poetry Mr. John Ryan.
Okay. I'll start with a new piece tonight because I'd like to see how this sounds for myself even. Okay, this is called Industrial Yard. Prodding at gravel beneath the nails. No messages on mobile phones, no dockets, no highlighted concerns or quandaries. Hardly any matter for the undernourished mind, in fine days or through gales. Order of fact as insignificant as quails. Imagining escaped prisoners' escapade, trying to transcend creative incarceration. Sandpaper might work on digits distraction, while the grains drop in chronology, flights of fancy are dynamite to present jail. Rotating a sequence, in anticipation at the window, the industrial yard is charred. Cranes, containers, and all freight pass by, their destination officially determined. The churn of engines, only a hiatus along the highway. Salmon can swim upriver, eels may conduct electricity and water, but for heavy duty transport, the carriage of goods, all is recessive, and the current keeps the noses of people monolateral. Masking the monotony of weekly travails, radio and newspaper, and gossip and the clever punchline. Paucity of pleasure, and then again decline in the weather. And thoughts wander like forgotten sports results. Battering down for the winter time, swallows start to disappear, like discarded betting slips. No let up in the juggernaut traffic. The cries and the din makes one feel as a fly within, and the attractive spun web of the spider, we who live inside are beguiled by her. So that's the new piece. I thought I'd do a reprise of one I did last week because I'm still trying to sort of get caught in with the vibrations of this one, whether it goes out in ripples or not, and I might eventually change it, but maybe I won't, I don't know. But I'm still kind of having a relationship with this piece. It's called Hope, Where Does It Live? Hope. Where does it go to when someone is sad, or another is thought of as mad? And in the case of the bereaved, does it go to seed? When there is danger in the dark, and when the heart is spent, and the cold finds the very marrow, does hope hide in a cave, protected by a gargantuan destiny hound, accompanied by thieves' white horses? Or does hope make itself invisible, twisting and turning in silhouette, as the dust disappears, the lonely disperses? Does hope live in a lair, all covered with creepers and vines? Or is it buried deep for a few to keep, in a box marked, only to be opened by the brave? Does it migrate like the swallows, or hide in hollows? Is it like the breeze the children wonder where it goes to when no wind is blowing? Is it replete, seeped underneath the skins of sinewy athletes and far-flung explorers? Can hope be measured? Or does it descend into void when under examination? Is hope an appetite that those that have been hurt lose? Or can it be replicated if we choose? Above all, is it always on the other side of a wall that must be knocked down sometimes, with grief and torrid passion, defiance and sometimes anger? Do the bricks in your wall gradually shift, giving way to a momentum, so that the mortar chaps into scream, and then there's a period of tension, a shimmer, a shake and a tremor? And when the wall falls, can you see through the dust and past the rubble, finding your way in careful progress, culminating in a way to live renewed, redirected, and the fulcrum sits? Thanks very much.
Last week, John Nilly Ray read here from his new book, The Well, and when I came in, I saw an elderly gentleman sitting across the way in a wheelchair, and I didn't realise it was Patrick Galvin, who was he's about 85 years of age, and he's an amazing Cork poet and singer, playwright. Just an amazing man. But I was blown away to see him in the wheelchair, and he's paralysed after a stroke on his right hand side, so, and he can't speak. And so he applauded by putting his left hand out, and his wife applauded with him. And so when I got home, I wrote this poem, so I called it, ironically, to the man who couldn't speak, I called it Obeah. And this is for Patrick Galvin. I anticipated a gaggle of local poets, and there he was, notably perched in the wheelchair, adjacent to a blotter soaked with love. Did I see him stroke the underbelly of his unborn poems, using his frozen oxygen, a chamfer of his observations nursing its way to blank vellum? Did I hear his didactic tongue clatter away, sending memos to his waiting a Eurovita tip? Did I see Sully whispering verses of encouragement in his good ear? Did I reach out and touch the stole that envelope you both in unisexual applause? Did I see you search for another half crown? I bet I did. Thanks. I went up to Limerick on Wednesday. I read in the White House in Limerick on Wednesday, and John Liddy was doing his Limerick launch of his book. So I spent some time with John afterwards on the pit, basically, at 5 o'clock in the morning, which is quite traditional. And At 4:30 in the morning, we were back in Tommy's house, and there's about 12 of us there, we were just talking, and we were talking about music, having spoken about anything else, we were talking about music in the 70s, and I was telling him how I had a folk club here in the city, and I mentioned a Limerick musician that I thought was really cool, and thought she was brilliant, who I knew sadly died in 1978, a year later. She drowned in the River Shannon. And John just looked at me, and he pulled away, took his latest poetry book out of his pocket, and read a poem that was dedicated to her, and about her in it, which was really weird for both of us. It was very, very strange. There was a lot more to it, so I got home at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I wrote this poem, and this is for John Liddy. I call it A Kennedy Moment. Mary, my lips hadn't blessed your name in a multitude of decades, not until you perched yourself between us tonight, landing yourself on a Republican lap. It was a Kennedy moment. Etching wasn't deep enough to hold you. The memories danced to polkas, reels and jigs, and were held in volumes of uninterrupted slow airs. When I looked again, I noticed that the tide had ebbed, and a feed bag of torment had discharged itself. You wore that same smile that introduced you to us in the Phoenix Bar in Cork in 1977, when your lips seduced the plastic tip and drove a decade of fingers to entertain us. Jesus, you were great. My memory fumbled and fumbled in its recall till you excavated a hunk of deep bored and unmarried memories, and exercised an unwelcome landscape that found an inappropriate home. I left my horse and danced my way through the streets that once held your stride, and winked at the variety of unwritten plaques that hold you now, unwittingly ordering a confluence of memories to entertain themselves. Later today, I'll drive to Cork, and on my way, I'll erect a cortege of finger posts to you, and bless them for a lifetime of acceptance. Thank you. Cutting the there, Paul.
Was I catching the river?
No, I was this is a...
No rush.
Actually, this is one I wrote recently as well, so it's three new poems. Nice. On Friday night, I was out on the pit. Sorry. I'm familiar. I don't think that often or that much normally, but I took the guys who worked for me out on Friday night, and it was a real kind of a macho night. We were all trying to compare who could drink the most, etc. So I got home pretty pissed, and my son Nick was sitting up listening to music and reading, so I just sat in the bed for 2 hours talking to him, and it's a blast, it's just what you're reading about son for 2 hours that hour of the night, and I went downstairs and I told him to fuck off. And I wrote this, and I dedicate this to Bob Welch, who lost his son tragically earlier this year, so, or last year, so I call it a euphony. As sons come, he's the one. Image set and done. Inoffensive. And radiating kiss high black of sincere and influenced free love. He is that sensitive free soul, a dictum, that is my son, Nick. That man whose quest it is to swim in my history. A loving oarsman dipping the craft-shaped pulling sticks of history in life's waters. A headstrong bullock, a set of vulnerable shoulders. The adult frame filling the office chair in work today is the boy in a mustard fleece top and brown corduroy pants, stanched in a blue pair of heroic wills that I love. Through the influential broadcast that my loving father said to me, I see you.
I've been bringing new clients into Havana for quite a while.
I think what's important is I'm enjoying it. I never read in public or ever did anything in public until I came here. I think it was 9 weeks ago.
I'm just going to read one poem because I actually came in to meet some people outside, so I'm going to just read. He wrote one for a deceased folk singer, so ballad singer. So I had one in my collection for also another singer, and who used to sing down at the Heron's Perch in Glanmire, and at the and at the session in the Singers Club, and it's Finbarra O'Callaghan. Did you know Finbarra from the County Bound? But he used to sing down at the Heron's Perch every Tuesday night, and he used to sit in the same seat all the time and sing his ballad, Finbarra. Although the bar is crowded and noisy, I narrow my eyes and imagine you sitting in that vacant chair by the payphone, a bottle of barley wine at your elbow, cigarette smouldering between thin fingers. You sing of Napoleon's retreat from Moscow. You sing of the wind in the western hills. You sing of peat bogs, grazing sheep, a diving hawk. Then the eccentric jackets from New York and the big trucks you drove each summer. We missed you and were always glad when autumn returned with a whiff of diesel, a bashful smile, a twinkling schoolboy's eye. Rhyming words and music filled your throat, painted a canvas unusually rare. Then suddenly, you were no longer there. Strangers now sit in that vacant chair, where once your ballads warmly filled the smoky air.
Thank you. relaxed talk and some music and some poetry. A couple of things on my mind this evening about Tara and traditional music, they come up in the poetry. And two things come up to me when I think about that. And the first thing is, and they're kind of interlinked really, I suppose one thing. The first thing is, reminds me that of the sense that the lack of respect that Irish people have often had for Irish culture. It reminds me during the week, I just heard that Irish music almost died in Ireland, and it was our good friends in America who basically saved Irish music by giving it the respect that it deserved. And then it was only then that Irish people started to respect what was here. And I suppose that leads me to think about what is Irish culture. And for me, I was speaking there to you about why I wasn't protesting. And I suppose it's because for me, Irish culture is not tied to a place. And I think that people from all over the world have the right to Irish music. There are people in America who've never been to Ireland playing Irish music, and that counts as Irish culture just as much people playing it here. And that's Irish culture, and it's been kept alive all over the world. Just as there's a band in Dublin playing Jewish music. And that's the way the world is going, and it's great. I think it's great development. So, I might start with the tune. And then I'll mix up some important.
It's a well run case.
That's true. I wasn't going to say tonight, but I thought the energy here was great tonight, so I thought it would work then. Actually, I'm a newcomer to Irish music, and it's ironic because I don't live too far from the pub that man spoke of there, the Irish music pub, but I was never there. It's kind of sad, really, in a sense, that I'm going to come to Irish music now. I was there in my history, but I trained in classical, so I'm trying to change over now.
Thank you.
but I don't. I'm not in the jazz scene as well. Unfortunately, not yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
They have a band called Calico here
yeah.
in Cork.
Yes.
You heard of Calico?
No, I haven't. No.
Okay. Well, he's playing here next in the next 5 to 6 Monday.
Okay. Very good. Yeah.
So, I mean, you may want to. Bring it along, just in case.
Yeah, I was going to wait until I knew to come to them because I knew there was kind of a music thing happening, but
okay.
I thought the energy here was great tonight, so I thought I'd say a few things.
Fair play. Excellent.
So now we're going to spoil this obviously important for that. This first poem is a little bit, I don't know, kind of strong, a little bit dark. So, be prepared. So this is, I call this Winner Sinner. And I'm going to try and do split the words, but I have a space in it there. Winning's a thing, don't care if you sin, to win is a thing. In our competitive society, money speaks louder than girls don't fit like car bombs in Baghdad. Win, don't care if you sin, winning's the thing. Win what, Dad? Don't care what you win, don't care if you sin, win's the thing. The girl is in a coma, her brain is gone, her dad looks on. While back in the West, we play war games for fun. Or is it just me, or is the fun disappearing once the kids start to fear? Win, to win is the thing, don't care if you sin, win's the thing. The girl is dead, her dad turns away, his face deeper than dismay. But it distresses me as much to see the parents of the West look on their child's best with distress. Thanks. And the next poem, probably my last one for tonight, celebrates the lecture slides, one of the lecture slides. This is for a girl I knew in Dublin, her name was Teresa. So I call this The Girl from the Cafe. Brazilian sweetheart, like the girl from Del Monte, winking at me across the counter of love. We kissed with Brazilian delight, your lips were warm and wet as an Irish summer. Your eyes teasing me like dancing moons, but I was already losing gravity and those moons fell away from me. Thanks very much. So I think I'll finish with one tune. Actually, there's one other poem I want to do before I finish up the poem. I wrote this 3 years ago now. I was doing a Buddhist meditation retreat in America, and this is the poem I wrote while I was there. So I call this All American Spirit. All American Spirit, in the cool autumn air, I die a little. The native spirits of the lake, how fresh and alive they seem. Plentiful hearts and plentiful meals. A delightful place to be. Thanks very much. Thank you. so much.
Last but not least on the list, we do have a third part to this evening, by the way. We all throw out five words randomly, and we take 10 minutes and we write about them in the 10 minutes. Perhaps include all five words. It can be as short or as long as you like. It can be one line poem or page poem. And then allow the chef to get 3 points. So that's up next. And I've got lots of pens and paper for all you voting enthusiasts. But last but not least.
Still, is that okay
with
that one?
Yeah,
all right. Marie Casey.
It was raining and the darkness of the morning was unsettling the town of Hanoi. The girl was crying as she stumbled through the pitfalls at her skin. Water streamed down her face and she looked occasionally, crying Akari Owan. With each cry, morning seemed to grow more chilling. And she heard the cry deep and loud within, Mare Norinda, Mare, more pressing than the rhythm of her racing heart. In the distance, she could hear the cries and the sound of sticks against the ground, and she knew that they were drawing near her. She felt her hungers within her, and pain struck her like pinpricks on the soles of her feet. She remembered the song that they sang in the village. The banks are oh so old, my dear, not where you ought to be, and the flood of water's edge, my dear, you do not want to see. She felt herself slipping in the mud. It was getting softer by the minute. The heavy rainfall fell onto her shoulders, and onto the sharp rocks. As a child, she had the strangest colour hair in the village. The girls of her own age had often played with it, tying knots in it, and fondling her face in a curious way, saying, you will find an office, Sarah. But she hadn't understood, hadn't understood at all. The wind shrieked as she felt herself being drawn to the river, a carrier on, and she heard it in the distance as if answering her, and she screamed, wondering what was her face. Face, what was face? Was it time for first blood, when she had felt so strange that she could rise between her legs to stem the flow and the uneasy weight that was in the air? Women were cornered watching her, and the men staring oddly at the ground. Feeling the threat that seemed to invade her, she had run to the river and put her hair in twist. She had crouched by the side and allowed the river to gently hold it in its grasp. It had helped her to deal with the fear rising within her. She had then stepped into it, removed the rags to allow the river to taste the blood, and the wind had begun to blow as if there was no one but her, the river, and the wind. From then on, she had often felt a desire rising her to spend time there and listen to the music that had been waiting. The music of its begetting far away from her, and the music that the river taught her rang in her ear, making her aware of things that lay in the wind, that whispered in the grasses, that laboured on the stones, seeing signs and bears, and she would sit on the bank and wonder. When Annie grew in the village, she knew that she was being watched, and men looking in their pockets for something, women dressing their hair, and she felt the fear within her, rising each passing day until she could bear it no longer. She decided to run. She ran to the next village, where a girl who had been kind to her lived. She might help her. She spent the night in terror, hoping that no one would see her escape the next morning. At dawn, she crept and began her planned route, but she had not reckoned that it would rain or that they had been waiting. She had reached the border of one field when a shout had risen into the air and the noise of sticks began. She now knew how a deer felt when a bugle was raised to begin a hunt. Her heart felt that it was going to come out. Things would, they would catch her on the path. In desperation, she looked to the river, and at that moment, she heard a wail, like lament, Moray Morinda, and her heart jumped in joy. It cut across the rain, holding her in its grip. She felt as if she wanted to cry. But it would not leave her. Their thoughts would not leave her. It said that she run, and she ran crying, Akari Owan. The river, she must get to the river. Her friends, it would help her, guide her. The noise of the men were very close now. Suddenly there was a roar as the water came. A wild torrent that took her in its wake, and she heard the sound, Mare Morinda, as far ahead stood a standing stone. She made herself ready, her arms found stone, and held her as she heard the cries of the giant.